welcome to Keep the Bastards Honest, the podcast of the Australian Democrats. I'm your host, Alana Mitchell, and on this episode, Labor adopts a Tony Abbott-devised climate policy. You're probably familiar with the phrase, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Well, my co-host Steve Beatty and I discovered that even the most loosely agreed upon talking points don't survive first contact with their podcast hosts. As I mentioned in the first half of this episode, we had planned to run through all the interesting issues that occurred in Australian politics while Steve was overseas, and we even agreed upon a list of topics so we wouldn't forget anything. And regular listeners will be completely unsurprised to discover that we got through exactly one topic on that list before we ran out of time in our recording session. It is a doozy, though, and it was worth diving into. It is, of course, the passage of the safeguard mechanism, the key plank of Labor's policy on addressing climate change. Now, dearest listeners, I do have to warn you that the language in this episode is slightly saltier than normal, partially, as Steve will point out, because I kept letting him talk, but mostly because this is a deeply frustrating topic for those looking for a science and evidence-based approach to the climate emergency. My apologies in advance if this is an issue for you. Steve and I pay our respects to the traditional custodians of the lands upon which we met and their elders past and present. Sovereignty never ceded. So as we record today, after much argy-bargy and angsting and, you know, callbacks to the CPRS in 2009, the Albanese Labor government and the Greens have actually struck a deal on the so-called safeguard mechanism.
It's worth reminding everybody just exactly what we're talking about with the safeguard mechanism and put it into a little bit of perspective. So the safeguard mechanism came into effect in July 2016, so it's an Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison government era idea. It was tinkered with a few times in 2017, 18, 2019. There were changes made to it to make it simpler and fairer. I think the main issue was to try and make it easier for those large carbon emitters to continue to emit more carbon. Essentially, the safeguard mechanism covers companies or operations that emit more than 100,000 tons of CO2 equivalent. And that's one of many sort of technical nuances or complications to the safeguard mechanism. But essentially, it takes out 215 largest emitters, those who emit over 100,000 tons of carbon a year, and puts in place some restrictions on them such that they reduce their emissions over time, thereby reducing Australia's carbon emissions and doing our bit to fight climate change. That's the theory of it. Whole bunch of issues with its design, more holes in it than fishnet stockings. It really just didn't work. To put it in simple terms, as a mechanism that was designed to reduce emissions, it did not.
And I can't help but feel that because this was an Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison government initiative, can't help but feel that maybe it was designed not to work.
It certainly feels that way. It certainly feels that way. When you sort of look at, let's take one simple example, right? So there's this whole idea that the safeguard mechanism works on the idea of a baseline. So you, Elena, you are a company that turns out steel girders, right? Like, so steel beams for the construction industry, you're a large scale emitter, you produce more than 100,000 tons of carbon a year by producing 100,000 tons of steel. Let's just keep it simple. So for every ton of steel you produce, you're producing a ton of carbon. Your baseline is 100,000 tons, and the idea is that you reduce it over time. There is a thing in there called a production-based baseline, and the idea is simply that if you increase your production, you can increase your baseline. So if you turn around and say, listen, next year we're going to produce 150,000 tons of steel, which means because it's one for one, we're going to have to emit 150,000 tons of carbon, the safeguard mechanism says, okay.
What?
It just doesn't make sense. If you're in one of the other categories, like energy generation, for example, and you emit 110,000, you know, like you go up by 10%, then you can simply buy carbon credits. And there are all sorts of issues with the carbon credits scheme in Australia, and it's been covered in quite a lot of detail by people like Polly Hemming over at the Australia Institute and Richard Dennis over there as well. They sort of get into the detail of the Australian carbon market and the carbon credit market in Australia. And they're basically worthless in the sense of, do they represent a reduction in carbon? Are they taking carbon out of the air, yes or no? And the answer is no in at least three quarters of the time. So, I can emit more pollution. I can buy effectively a junk carbon credit and everyone's happy. And that's me meeting my obligations within the safeguard mechanism as it was first conceived. In a nutshell, everybody, all 215 of those biggest emitters in the country, we could all increase our emissions year on year and still technically be within the safeguard mechanism, still meeting our obligations under the safeguard mechanism, even though we continue to increase our carbon emissions. It was a really bad design.
Wow. And I mean, in a completely different discussion, a friend said to me today, you're applying logic, don't do that. That confuses people. Just the sheer logic, like, how is that supposed to meet our Paris targets? How is it supposed to meet the bullshit 43% target that Labor went to the election on and insisted on implementing when they
this is why Labor wants to improve the safeguard mechanism, right? So they've said, no, we're going to make changes to it. We're going to improve it. It's there and that's working, but we want to make it better. And this is what the whole negotiation is about, because we weren't going to make 43% otherwise. And we were in this situation where emissions could keep going up and still notionally be within the constraints of the mechanism. Really not very tight constraints is the bottom line in what was there before.
And I don't want to sound like a party pooper or anything, but it... I mean, this sort, you know, as a Machiavellian sleight of hand, giving the impression we're doing something about emissions while actually allowing people to increase their emissions freely is classic Abbott Morrison bollocks.
Absolutely.
But you can't get away from the minor technical detail that all these extra emissions means that we're going to cook the planet and we're going to die.
The Morrison government in particular was very much helped by the fact that the drought broke. And I say that because as a result of the drought breaking, and you may recall Australia was in the grip of a rather sort of severe drought during the period leading up to 2019. We had the major bushfires on the back of it, and essentially the bushfires and the drought were broken in early 2020. When the rains came, we got some really good rains, flooding rains in some cases, and I don't want to minimize the impact that that had. But one of the things that it did do was it kicked off several years of growth. So grasses, flowers, trees, wetlands, all of these really good carbon sinks essentially flourished. And the government was able as a result to say, look at our emissions coming down. We're fantastic. Our emissions are coming down year on year. We're awesome. If you take out that land use component, then emissions went up over that period by about 7%. And over the course of the Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison government, we really did bugger all in terms of reducing our emissions from the things that we control.
Well, I'm just thinking about, you know, those Black Summer bushfires and... I mean, they're emissions of a different type, but...
12 million hectares of trees and forest releases a hell of a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. Absolutely. Yeah.
And also, like, when we're not even touching on the, you know, the minor technical detail of the methane in the atmosphere either, because carbon, at least, you can sequester, you can pull it out of the atmosphere. You can't pull methane out of the atmosphere.
Not in the same way. No. It doesn't operate in the same way, and it is a more intensive greenhouse gas. So let me just give two other bits of context before we sort of talk about the changes that were negotiated. So the second bit of context, and you've touched on it already, is that the Labor government went to the last election with a platform to reduce carbon emissions by 43% by 2030. That was their platform going into the election. Other parties had different targets. We know that ours was 60 to 65% in the same time frame. The Greens were looking for carbon net zero by 2035, and I think it was a 70 or 75% cut by 2030. The Teal independents varied depending on which one in particular you look at, but broadly they were in the spectrum from sort of 50% cuts through to about 65%, depending on who you're talking to in particular. And they also got elected. So Labor have gone and formed government, and they've turned around and said, we have a mandate for a 43% emissions reduction target. The Greens have said, well, we've got 11 Senate seats. We've got a mandate for a 70%, 75% reduction, and no new coal, oil, and gas. And various sort of Teal independents have said, well, I've got a mandate. My community wants 50% or 55% or 65%, whatever it might be. So you've got this sort of collection of people going, we have a mandate and here's what it looks like. And newsflash, you don't all have a mandate. In fact, like none of you really get to call it all on your own. The second thing, though, is that on last Monday night, the IPCC released the last part of its sort of round six reports, the synthesis report, which pulls together all of the information from the previous five reports and put out this quite detailed summary of here is everything that we've pulled together over the last cycle. And I can't recall exactly how long each reporting cycle is, but it's years long. It involved hundreds of scientists, tens of thousands of pages of scientific literature. It was ultimately signed off by 195 countries. And it boils down to, we're fucked if we don't do something seriously. That's the short version.
Is that the technical sort of executive summary?
The technical version of the executive summary literally is, we're fucked if we don't do something. And they mean that quite literally. Like the environmental tipping points and the climatic tipping points are quite severe. We're getting quite close to them. They include things like the collapse of various glaciers in the Arctic and the Antarctic, a shift in weather patterns, heat waves, more extreme droughts, this kind of thing. We've just seen Cyclone Freddy, which lasted for a month, give or take a few days. It is unprecedented, and it's going to become commonplace. If you're wondering what that might look like in the future, the red spot on Jupiter is a cyclone that's been running for 400 years, and we are very much in for that kind of shit if we're not careful. So the IPCC report was really, really clear. We've got to do something much more serious than countries have currently indicated. The sorts of policies that are in place are going to take us well beyond 1.5% warming, more likely 2 to 3% warming. And that is not just uncomfortable, it's unlivable for large parts of the country. So that's the context in which we now come to Labor and the Greens today talking about their negotiations on the safeguard mechanism. In order to meet Labor's 43% target, the safeguard mechanism is a key plank. So it's one of the key ways that they've said we are going to meet that target. So it's important that it does its job, but even doing its job as it was envisaged by Labor only gets us to 43%, which is at the low end of what different mandates indicate. And it's about 50% of what we actually need it to be. We need it to be far more substantial than that, or it's about two-thirds of what we need, give or take.
Didn't the, and I could be wrong here, but didn't the IPCC report strongly suggest that we actually need to hit net zero by 2035?
Pretty much, rather, yeah.
So if our goal is 43% by 2030, there's a lot of emissions cutting that we need to do in the 5 years after that.
Well, so the Labor Party's policy is net zero by 2050. They haven't updated it at all. They've indicated before that they won't update it before the next election. So they'll take a new set of targets to the next election, which is 2 years away and, frankly, is a bullshit response. Like, you can't take 2 years to respond to a body of scientific evidence that says run like the house is on fire because the house is on fire and go, yeah, okay, we'll formulate a response in 2 years' time. We'll take it to the electorate and see what they have to say. That's exactly the opposite of the sort of urgency that we need. And then all of the criticism around the safeguard mechanism in that it actually doesn't enforce a reduction in emissions in the first place. And when it does, it's reliant on these shitty carbon credits that aren't actually taking carbon out of the air. So all sorts of issues with the whole idea of how do we meet a shitty target in the first place.
Yeah, oh, there's so much that's wrong with this. And the thing that Adam Bandt in particular, but the Greens have been quite agitated about, like, has been the Labor's refusal to commit to no new coal and gas projects.
That's
now,
right.
We've got to be really careful here because the framing of this by Labor, by climate-denying apologists in the media, by the coalition has been, well, you can't just turn off coal and gas overnight. That's crazy.
The lights will go out.
Yeah. And it's like, well, that's not what no new coal and gas projects means because
the sentence, right?
That's right, right? It's literally what it says in the books. We already have 116 or 118 coal and gas projects approved or going through approvals in the pipeline, basically scheduled to go. And what we're saying is, can we maybe stop after 116 or 118? Can we not approve any more after this pipeline that we've already got? And apparently that's impossible. And are you crazy? And what the hell?
There are projects in that list of 116. So the Beetaloo Basin is one. The Scarborough project in West Australia is another. The safeguard mechanism looks to save eventually something like 205 million tonnes of carbon per year. It's about a third of what Australia produces at the moment in its entirety. So, like, it's a big deal if it's actually saved. Yay, it's a big chunk out of what we need to save. The Scarborough project alone will add 1.6 billion tonnes of carbon. It just dwarfs the amount that we're saving from the entire scheme. Like, it's and it's not the worst of the ones on the list. It's not good, but it's not the worst of the things that we're talking about. What's planned in the Galilee Basin, the expansions there with the Dani and the Carmichael coal mine, what's planned in the Beetaloo Basin with the gas extraction, what we're looking at doing in the Pilliga Forest and in Narrabri in New South Wales, like both of those projects, which are probably going ahead, all of it just wipes out any gains that we get from the safeguard mechanism. So if you're going to do a safeguard mechanism, you really want to make it good. But at the same time, we should be able to say, can we not keep throwing fuel on the fire? Like, we're literally throwing more fuel on the fire whilst getting the garden hose out to put it out. You know, it's not sensible.
No. So I kind of feel for the frustration of the Greens in all this because the way the debate has been painted and the way it's been framed by the media has been, and it's probably habitual in with the media to frame the Greens as being perpetually unreasonable.
Yes.
And, to be, I don't want
sometimes
to be fair to
they
media.
Are, but yes.
Sometimes they are. Thank you. Yes. In this instance, I do find myself violently agreeing with them because their position is in line with the science. It is in line with fact. It is in line with evidence. And it's Labor and everyone essentially to the climate denying right of Labor who are actually being unreasonable.
It really should be a sensible proposition. God, look, the International Energy Agency, which represents oil, gas, and coal interests around the world, said last year that if we're going to meet our obligations under the Paris Agreement, that essentially means no new coal, oil, and gas. Like, they said it.
Yeah.
They said it. They said, look, this is what the science tells us, so what are you going to do? And what do? We queue up 100 new coal, oil, and gas projects and go, yeah, but economy, which is a whole other, sort of pile of bullshit over there. But let's not head down that path.
No,
I mean, we're well and truly painted into a corner on this one, and yeah. We've spent, you know, like I don't know how many months arguing in the media that the Greens have got to remember what happened in 2009 when they voted against the CPRS, and you know, we ended up with a carbon price that Abbott was able to throw out, and rah rah rah. And my favourite is don't let perfect be the enemy of the good, as though this is anything approaching good.
Yes, you know, this is, yes. Well, yeah. Or that asking for, could we at least line up with where the science sits, is somehow the perfect.
Yeah. know? Yeah. It's not even close.
Yeah.
You know, if perfect were a gourmet meal, this is sort of hospital food.
And the Greens are basically asking for Maccas. Like it's not, you know.
Yeah, just bare minimum, literally bare minimum. Literally yeah. The bare minimum.
This is what state capture looks like. And it's insanely frustrating and dire risk of getting very, very sweary as the deeper we dive into this. But
because you keep letting me talk. Yeah.
But we last year the country got rid of a corrupt and climate denying government in the Morrison government. There was no two ways about it. And we ushered in a Labor government in the hope that they would actually do something and that it would be better and that now we can transform the country. And it's so disappointing that not even 12 months after being elected, the most that they've managed to achieve is a kind of lame argument of, well, at least we're not the Morrison government. And it's like, guys,
that's a low bar.
You need to be, yeah, it's a low bar and you've barely scraped over it. Like at the rate you're going, you're actually going to crash into it.
Yeah, on this issue in particular, we need them to be a lot better. Like we're much, much better. And we've wasted 9 years under the coalition government not acting seriously enough and letting our emissions go up, not putting in place the appropriate mechanisms so that this kind of stuff would happen year on year where our emissions would come down. And as a result, we're in a situation where instead of saying we need to reduce our emissions by a further 40% or 50%, which is what we might have been talking about had they actually done shit for the last 10 years, because they haven't and they've actually been increasing, we're now in a position where we have to say, well, look, it's got to be 70, 75% by 2030 because you've kept piling fuel on the fire. And so we find ourselves with the Greens and the crossbench arguing with Labor on what does a bare minimum look like and what can we all stomach and what can we all call a win so that this thing gets voted in and at least we've made some progress. And it seems like they did this morning after however long these negotiations have been going on. Adam Bandt separately, I might add, but Adam Bandt came out and made some statements this morning, and Anthony Albanese with Chris Bowen made some statements as well, to the effect that they've agreed on changes to the safeguard mechanism that they can all live with, and it will go ahead.
The fact that both the Greens and, like you said, they both seem to be willing to live with it, that in itself is a breakthrough because...
That's something, yeah.
Yeah, like I saw somewhere, one thing that people like you and I need to take into account is the fact that Labor hates the Greens way more then they fear community backlash about their inability to reduce emissions and do something about climate change per their promise in the lead up to the election.
I bet something, yep.
Yeah. And so Labor's instinct to wedge the Greens and deny them not even a win but anything approaching to cooperation has been a key factor. Like anyone who's either been observing or is listening to us bang our heads on the desk wondering why this has been so hard, the key factor is a simple fact that, particularly since the CPRS debacle in 2009, Labor do not want to play with the Greens. They don't want to be anywhere near the Greens. They don't want the Greens contributing to anything, particularly now that they're in power and they're governing. So I have to give both parties credit. The fact that they've managed to negotiate something that they can both live with is really something.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
Yep.
But all that said, what is it that they've negotiated? What have they agreed to?
So I think there are two key points that are worth highlighting. And these seem to be the two changes at the heart of the mechanism. So as I mentioned before, earlier on, one of the big issues with the current safeguard mechanism is that gross emissions can increase. So our 215 largest emitters are able to increase their emissions. And I think it's basically unlimited, given that they can just buy the offsets that they need. There was no actual cap on the safeguard mechanism. So despite the baselines, and they were treated as baselines, there really was no limit or ceiling on emissions. The Greens have managed to negotiate a hard cap on gross emissions for those emitters. So before they can purchase any offsets, that amount is now fixed. So I saw various figures today, but essentially whatever it is today, they can't exceed that in the future. They have to come down, and the ratchet mechanism says that that needs to come down by a certain amount year on year, which is how we get our reductions.
Right.
That's a big thing, because one of the question marks was around new operations being able to join the safeguard mechanism, open up and adding to the pool of emissions that were within it. And essentially that means that any new operation needs to be accommodated by the others.
Oh.
Now that will drastically reduce the ability for any new operation to get up and running.
So that is severely going to impact the pipeline of 116 projects.
What it means is that I could, if I'm Woodside, for example, or Glencore or one of those other rapacious entities, I can shut down an operation. So Santos might shut down a series of gas wells in South Australia and open up their gas wells in Narrabri because they can do that cheaper than it currently costs them to do it in South Australia. So we've got a new thing, but we've lost the old thing, and the net gain is zero. Right. So that can still happen. From an environmental point of view, that's still bad. Like those new gas operations, especially where some of them sit. So in the midst of the Pilliga Forest, that's a bad thing. Plans on the Liverpool Plains, that's a bad thing. The Beetaloo Basin, which again, bad thing. So you don't really want them opening under any circumstances, but the mechanism would still allow someone to essentially trade their operation and say, we'll shut down one that is more polluting or less valuable or less productive for us, and we'll open a new one that is better for us, so that they can still do that kind of thing. The second thing, though, and this is again, it's a key shift, but there are some caveats to it. But the second one is that any new operations need to be net zero from day one. So if you do open up in, say, the Beetaloo Basin, and that is one that's been brought up a number of times, they need to purchase enough offsets to cover their Scope 1 emissions, which are the emissions from production, on day one. The recommendation was that, so the recent review into the credit market and the Australian emissions reduction policies sort of recommended that actually be Scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, that it all be net zero from day one. And I won't go into the technicalities of what we mean by Scope 1, 2, and 3, but it means that only part of the emissions are being covered and only part of the emissions are being offset. And the really critical part is that the emissions that come from actually burning the coal, oil, or gas aren't being offset at all.
And because I think it was Tanya Plibersek, I think, came out with a... And look, I might be maligning her unfairly, but there seemed to be this sort of narrative of once we dig it out of the ground and ship it overseas and someone else burns it, well, that's not our problem.
Yeah, that's a drug dealer's response.
Yeah. Right?
Like I'm just selling it. What you do with it is up to you. And if I don't sell it to you, somebody else will. Like that's a drug dealer's response. Like that's not foreign policy. It's certainly not environmental policy, and it definitely doesn't align with the science on the issue.
Well, no, because I mean that's all well and good, but like Australia doesn't have a separate
atmosphere.
It doesn't matter if this. Do you know what I mean? Like it doesn't matter if this shit gets burnt in Australia or burnt in India or Singapore.
It's why we care about land clearing in the Amazon. It's why we care about land clearing and cutting down forests in Indonesia. It's why we care about wildfires in California. Sure, we can't smell the smoke, but we sure as hell are on the receiving end of all of those forests no longer transforming carbon dioxide into air and taking it out of the atmosphere. Like, we absolutely need those things. Go figure, we're all on the one planet.
Yeah.
So those two changes are good. Like, in and of themselves, they're good. And I think the introduction of that cap, that absolute cap on emissions, is probably the biggest one. It was interesting, though, that in the Financial Review today, the owners of the Beetaloo Basin operation came out and went, "You can't stop us. We're still going to do what we said we were going to do, and the Greens can go themselves." I don't care what Adam Bandt says. Like, literally, that was their response this afternoon. You know, like, the Greens think that they've put a stop to our operation in the Beetaloo Basin, but they're wrong. So that kind of undermines my confidence in the safeguard mechanism of doing anything useful when a brand new operation like that one can sit there and go, "Yeah, we'll still go ahead."
Look, I guess it's progress. It's certainly not anything to be super excited about.
So the problem is that this is the key strategic plank, policy plank in Labor's emissions reduction platform. If this doesn't significantly reduce carbon emissions, then nothing will until the 2025 election, if maybe Labor can get re-elected. It certainly won't get reduced if a Liberal Party or a coalition party comes into power. So if Labor can be re-elected, if enough leverage can be applied by the crossbench and the Greens and other minor parties, maybe then you'll see some further action. But this is it for the next 2 years. Like, that's the problem with it. It's not ambitious enough. And then one of the things in the mechanism around in the safeguard mechanism, there's this issue of, you know, how do we enforce that emissions are actually reducing? And in fairness to the operators, those measurements and the enforcement of those emissions reductions will be done on a 5-year rolling basis.
Right.
It's 2023 now. We don't have a system in place right now. We don't have a formal system of measuring emissions that sit within the mechanism necessarily. So you can pretty much guarantee that any rolling 5-year basis is going to start year one now, and in 5 years we'll be in a position to go, your emissions aren't reducing enough, we need more carbon credits. It simply means there's a very real potential that no serious action on emissions reduction will happen for 5 years, 2028. And for a series of targets that really we needed action by 2030, and this was the decade for it, you know, it was meant to begin in 2020, we were meant to have all of this progress was meant to be made. I think from what we've seen today, we're going to be sitting here in 2028 going, yeah, it's not happening.
Fuck. I mean, particularly if the IPCC is correct and we need to get to net zero by 2035. And yeah, not
there's no way we can do it from that point in 7 years, right? Like, and then everyone will be able to sit there and go, "Oh, that'll wreck the economy." Well, so will wildfires and droughts and floods and cyclones that are permanent, sweeping up and down the Australian coastline. Like, that's going to wreck the economy as well. I tell you what, when a cyclone hits Sydney or Melbourne, that'll wreck the economy. Between now and 2028, that will happen. We will get a cyclone hit that far south that it'll hit Sydney. Never happened in my lifetime. I've lived in Sydney 52 years. It's never happened. It's never even come close. And yet we're now getting tornadoes as a regular occurrence. We never got those either.
And you can imagine, and look, I'm not a meteorologist, so I've got no idea if this is even scientifically feasible, but imagine a cyclone or, you know, the Antarctic equivalent coming out of Antarctica and burying Melbourne in ice. You know?
Well, we see it in North America, right? Like, we see the Arctic vortex sort of break out of its little bounds the Arctic normally circulates in, come down into North America. I don't know whether you saw, like, there were some amazing photos from the current winter in America, but there were photos I saw last week of someone digging a path to their car. Now, the car was a good, I'd say, 15 feet under snow. It was a good 15 feet of snow over this car. And that was one storm that lasted a few days kind of thing and absolutely hammered down. But when places like California get snow and a lot of snow, it tells you that things are off kilter, and absolutely the same thing could happen. Now, maybe it won't get to Melbourne, but it would get to Hobart.
Yeah.
It would get to Tasmania as a whole. You could see snow right across Hobart or right across Tasmania and absolutely bury the island in snow. Imagine Perth getting hit by a cyclone. Again, like, easy. But yeah, if a cyclone can bounce around the Indian Ocean for 30 days, it can absolutely wind its way down the coast and hit Perth.
Yeah. Our weather already is affected by, because we get cyclones up north in the Pilbara.
Yeah.
And that does impact the weather in Perth. So in February, you know, February, March, when it's cyclone season, mm-hmm. we get rain, we get massive humidity, we get Sydney-style humidity, which is always fun. And that's a normal cycle. That's I've experienced that my entire 46 years on the planet.
That's right. Yep.
So it's completely feasible that instead of hitting Broome or Karratha or Dampier, it could come down and hit Geraldton or come down and hit Perth.
So what happens at the moment is that it hits places like Broome and starts to wind its way down the coast and basically flattens out. It loses its intensity and it hits Perth and Geraldton as a big storm, and you get a lot of rain, and that rain's not fun, but it doesn't come with the winds and the damage that comes as a result. Same in Sydney. Yeah. We get the tail ends of tropical cyclones that hit Queensland. They work their way down the coast, and by the time they hit Sydney, they're a depression, you know, a tropical depression, and we get like a whole bunch of rain and a bit of wind, but it's not a cyclone. That will change because we're not doing the things that we need to stop it happening, and we continue to do the things that will make it work. Like, it's basically guaranteed.
Yeah. And what really annoys me and what I find really disappointing, this is the one issue where, and I'm not going to use the word mandate, but it was the one issue where there was no opposition from the public on this. The public sent a very, very firm message to our political class that, you know, we rejected the climate denialism and bullshit of the Morrison government, and Labor were voted in on the expectation that they would actually do something about this. And much of their rhetoric in the lead up to the election was based on that. And now that they're in power, this is the one issue that should be dead easy for them. Mm. And they're blowing it. And because I've seen Labor apologists go, oh, but they've got, you know, they've got a decade of climate coalition destruction to clean up. We can't raise the rate. We can't do this. You know, the Murdoch papers will crucify them. You've got to give them a second turn to do the big, you know, the big transformative stuff. You've got to, you know, got to be patient. The one issue that did not apply to, and that particular argument is a whole other podcast, but the one issue that did not apply to was action on climate change.
This one, right? Yeah. The hottest temperature ever recorded in Australia is 50.7 degrees.
Jesus.
50.7. It was recorded in Western Australia in a place called Onslow, which is up on the coast, what looks like around Port Hedland, up around there somewhere, just on the on the knobby bit of WA before it heads into Broome. In January last year, right? And that was in a year of La Nina, not El Nino. We will break that record this coming summer. So summer, January 2024, December 23, we will break that record. I'll put money on it based on sort of where we are right now. And 50 degrees will get broken in Sydney, and it will get broken in South Australia and all of the places that you currently look at and go, oh, yeah, but it's never hit that there, will all get broken. And we will look back on it in 10 years' time as a pretty benign event. I remember when it was only 50 and we thought that was hot.
Yeah.
That's where we're headed. And we just, like, the IPCC report made it really, really clear that it won't get better unless we start reducing carbon.
Mm.
Like it really is that simple. And we're only talking about doing the first part. The first part is to stop putting more carbon into the air to get to net zero. That just halts the decline. It doesn't improve stuff at all. It's not like by getting to net zero, we go back to, you know, what it was like when I was a kid in the 70s. It just stops it getting any worse than it is right now. Then we need to start thinking about, well, how do we actually draw that carbon out of the air? How do we change our practices, you know, on a global scale so that we're actually pulling carbon out of the air and doing things with it, pulling methane, pulling carbon dioxide out of the air so that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere starts to come back down again. It's at 420 parts per million at the moment, and really it should be down around 340. And that's a big, big drop that has only happened in my lifetime. We've gone from that level to where we are today, basically over the last 50-odd years. The first step is to just stop making it worse, and we don't seem to be able to do that part of it. Like just don't seem to be able to do that part of it. We're like a two-year-old pissing in our bath, and we just won't stop. It's unbelievable. I'm frustrated by today. Like I really am. And as much as people say it's progress in the barest terms. It's dragging your feet through the supermarket, you know, being dragged along by your parents because you don't want to go shopping anymore. Like it's, okay, I'll grudgingly walk, but I'm going to do it as slowly as I can, and I'm going to be a complete brat about it. That's kind of the level of policy that we've seen today.
Yeah.
Like it's not the bare minimum. It's a really, really shitty substitute for the bare minimum.
No, when we seem to be stuck with yet another, you know, government that is gaslighting the nation on what is actually possible.
John Kudelka has been on fire this week. I don't know whether you've seen some of his tweets over, especially like today, but even over the weekend, he was very much unhappy.
He was, yes. And I know that, like, you were trying to agree with him and he took you to task.
I was agreeing with him and I was making an intellectual point, and he had no time for my intellectual points. He was, you know, take your intellectual point and go fuck yourself with it, because I'm just pissed off.
Like, yeah.
Okay, that's fair enough.
That's fair enough.
I see where you're coming from. I see your point of view. And he's right.
He's correct.
It is fundamentally insufficient what we've seen today. So, look, I'm glad everyone's able to pat themselves on the back about how well they're working together. I think it's really important for everyone to understand that can't be the end of it. It's just not good enough. We've taken a step away from being nowhere to being somewhat less than nowhere, but still nowhere like where we need to be on this issue. We're just not taking it seriously enough at a policy point of view. It's still being treated as a political issue, and we're going to burn for it.
And that's what's frustrating, because when the media are reporting on it as a, oh, you know, will the Greens cave, or will they be wedged, or will they have a repeat of 2009 and doom us for another decade? Because, of course, it's all the Greens' fault. I don't mean to sound like a Greens apologist, but on this one, I'm kind of with them. And then it's the whole, will Labor prevail against the Greens? And if one of them blinks, what does this mean for everyone?
Just about the politics.
And then like, the Greens are being reasonable and going, but the science and future generations and the bare fucking minimum. And Labor to Labor, it's a political game. It's a game of chicken and a game of brinkmanship where they don't want to give the Greens a win. They can't bring themselves to acknowledge that the Greens in this instance are actually correct. They have the weight of the IPCC, the UN, the science, the fucking atmosphere behind them. We haven't scrapped the surface of policy yet.
No. And the thing is, the release of the IPCC report on Monday last week gave Labor every opportunity to sit there and go, actually, you know what? We need to do more. We went to the election with 43%. The scientific community, the UN, like everybody is telling us that that's not good enough, that we need to do more. So we're going to do more. This is a key part of what we're planning. We're going to rework it and make it stronger. Perfect cover. Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect cover, you would think. That's not a broken promise. That's actually responding to world events. Yes. And instead they've gone, I can't let the Greens. The Greens will say, we told you so, and I can't live with that.
Yeah, we can't allow that to happen. You're completely right. I mean, the timing of the IPCC report was perfect for Labor to back away gracefully and actually be a responsible government. Chris Bowen tweeted, I think it was last week, about, the Australian public have, basically demanded action on climate change and this is what we're doing about it. And the Twitter team took him to task quite strongly over that and called bullshit on his hypocrisy. Yeah. Because that's what it is. And it's just when the political class, and I include the media in that, cannot see beyond the politics, they have no place governing. I don't care if this team is slightly better than the team we just got rid of, because on this, they're kind of in lockstep.
Compared to where we need to be, they're nowhere near where we need to be. It's as simple as that. And look, if you do a sort of quick run around the states, every state has problems. It's not just at a federal level. Every state has problems. They're all undermining their efforts with approving new coal, oil and gas, approving new exploration licenses, cutting down native forests, approving land clearing in Queensland. They're all doing something that you can point at and go, well, that's just silly. South Australia are probably one of the better ones. Tasmania might be there or thereabouts. The bigger ones, WA included, Queensland, Victoria, New South Wales, they're all making decisions that undermine any kind of progress that they might make by converting the electricity grid, which is the thing that they're focused on, without actually tackling one of the key issues, which is the East Coast gas market and the fact that we export 3/4 of what we dig out of the ground. But let's not start on that little can of worms. But the fact that they approve these new projects, the fact that they haven't tackled the gas export market, the fact that we do still allow for logging of native forests, like these are all things that you just look at and go, you can't be taking this issue seriously if you go and do those things. Everything that you say over here about what a serious issue it is, if you really believe that, you'd stop doing this thing over here.
Now that we have wall-to-wall Labor governments on the mainland, they don't really have any excuses left because, as you said, ironically, Tasmania, led by Liberal government, is actually probably the closest one to actually being responsible and getting their emissions down, even though they're still not close to where they should be. But they can't argue that, it's the Liberals in this state, then therefore they won't cooperate, we can't do anything. It's like, guys, you literally run the country now. Sorry, yeah. Tasmania.
You've proven that you can do what you want, kind of. Yeah. I should say Tasmania is currently operating on more than 100% renewable energy. It exports excess all the time to Victoria and into the East Coast energy grid. It's got a target of 200% of its own energy needs, so it'll generate the same again and export that to Victoria. It's one of the main ways that Victoria is bringing down its emissions from electricity generation because they keep burning coal and gas. South Australia, the same. South Australia is now operating at 90% renewables on its energy grid. There are days, absolutely, when it exports its excess energy into Victoria and the East Coast market as well. So they're doing things, but as I say, they still allow other stuff that sort of undermines that. If you drive around Tasmania, you'll see a lot of houses burning wood for heating, for example. Mm. A lot of wood stoves used for heating in Tasmania. There's still a lot of clearing of forests. There's still a lot of logging that goes on, that kind of thing. But they, at least on the energy side, are doing something. The other states, I don't know. The best of them just seem determined to screw it up.
Yeah, and look, the two resource states, WA and Queensland, we're miles behind everybody. I mean, we get to be really smug because we do actually have a gas reservation policy, which means that our gas gas prices have gone up, but they're not crippling. They're way cheaper. It's I've compared my gas bill with the bills of gas of friends in the eastern states, and they have been horrified at the difference. But we're still approving things like Scarborough, which aren't just environmentally horrific. They're culturally in terms, well, yeah. They're culturally horrific as well in terms of the impact on Indigenous heritage.
Like, you can't justify it. Like, the only way to explain any of those decisions is money. And the amount of money that accrues to Australia is so small in the scheme of things that you wonder why we're selling ourselves so cheaply.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, like, yeah.
Are we really that cheap?
Apparently we are. You know, because it really is obscene. You look at Qatar, you look at Norway.
Yeah.
You know, the other big fossil fuel states, and the amount of money that they're actually extracting out of their fossil fuel sales.
Yeah.
We're literally giving it away. And it's ridiculous. Like we really are a country led by very unimaginative people. Thank you, Steve, as always, for your passion and your insights. The Democrats are kicking off a review of the policy platforms we took to the 2022 election, mostly to update them where the evidence or circumstances have evolved or changed. But if you'd like to have a look at our decade of climate action policy and see how we would have handled this issue, I've put a link in the show notes. We're still 2 years away from the next federal election, but the work of a political party never stops. If you're passionate about something that's covered in our policy platforms and want to lend a hand in updating them with the latest evidence, you're most welcome to join in. Just drop us a note at info@democrats.org.au and we can put you in touch with the policy team. We've got state elections coming up in Queensland and Western Australia in the next 2 years as well, and we're working toward registering at state level in order to contest both of those elections. If you live in either Queensland or WA and you'd like to help us get registered, you can do so just by joining the party. We need 500 members in each of these states in order to qualify for registration, so every member counts, and you can join for free. As always, I've put a link in the show notes. Coming up, Steve and I will finally talk in depth about the New South Wales state election, now that the count is complete and the results have been finalised, and we have a chat with Leonie Green about the Aston by-election and what's going on with the Liberal Party in Victoria. Keep the Bastards Honest is brought to you by the Australian Democrats. This episode was edited and produced by me, Alana Mitchell. If you'd like to keep in touch, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn by searching for Australian Democrats, and you can see what we stand for, what we value, and what our policy positions are at our website at democrats.org.au. Until next time, thanks for listening.